This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. During our long hiatus, I received an email from one of our listeners who wrote me the following. I have been listening to your show for quite some time now. I had been trying for a long time to find a good philosophical podcast, an interesting phenomenon in itself, but had perpetually met with failure until, love at first listen, I found Entitled Opinions. That's one way of defining Entitled Opinions, a show for those who otherwise meet with perpetual failure when they search for a good philosophical podcast. We cover a lot more than philosophy around here, as the Brigade knows well, but whether the topic is literature, biology, cosmology, psychiatry, religion, evolution, or corporations, Entitled Opinions brings an insurgent, extracurricular philosophical reflection to bear on it. Trying to make it real compared to what? That's our spirit. They can eat their dinner on philosophy talk, eat their pork and beans. On Entitled Opinions, we eat more chicken any man ever seen. That's right. The band is at hand. The priest is at the feast. Amor is at the door. What gets put on in the east gets taken off here in the west. So you just get here, and we'll take care of the rest. My guest today turns out to be the person who wrote me the email in question. But before we engage her on the topic of bioethics, I would like to take a moment to clarify something I mentioned toward the end of the recent show we aired on Charles Darwin, and which I brought up again during our show with photographer Lena Herzog. It has to do with what I called nature's essayistic manner of going about the business of natural selection. A number of you were intrigued enough to ask me to clarify and elaborate exactly what I meant when I declared that if I were God and my intention were to create the most diversified, complex, wondrous, and beautiful biosphere possible, I could think of no better mechanism to put in place than the creative, albeit cruel, process of natural selection. I define that mechanism as essayistic in the sense that at any given moment in the development of an individual, species, or biogroup, there exists an enormous overload of putulating genetic possibilities and random mutations, the vast majority of which are not selected successfully, but which nevertheless continue to get generated, discarded, and recombined in the great cauldron of the evolutionary process. Since only a tiny fraction of the proliferating possibilities gets realized, most of nature remains in a state of sheer potential, a potential for life rather than life itself. And if we could do an inventory of this near life, I don't know what else to call it, we would be astonished at how ingenious creative evolution actually is when it comes to monitoring the fierce struggles that take place on the boundary lines between possibility and actuality. The genius of nature is that it really does not know what it is doing when it evolves its species. Not if we conceive of knowledge the way the Western tradition has tended to conceive of it. Aristotle, with his unparalleled common sense, declared that a craftsman must have foreknowledge of what he intends to build if he hopes to bring it into being. Thus, the carpenter must know the form of a table, must have in his mind a concept of table, before he can go about making one out of the wood in his workshop. A house does not come into being by chance, but by design. The ontotheological idea of God in the Western tradition is largely that of the ultimate craftsman in whose divine mind the design of creation pre-exists the act of creation. God produces the world through his foreknowledge of its species and his power to actualize them into being from out of the chaos of undifferentiated matter. Grasping the essence and totality of the whole beforehand, God assigns its parts accordingly. This is more or less what Leibniz meant when he declared that we live in the best of all possible worlds, namely, that God, through his omniscience and goodness, actualized le meilleur des mondes possibles, the best of possible worlds, and that he really had no choice in the matter. Nature does something similar, but in a very different way, namely, without necessity and without foreknowledge. What became clear with Darwin is that nature does not operate like a craftsman or, what amounts to the same, like the ontotheological God of creation, for nature does not know what it is doing, does not foresee its creative evolution. Instead, it has a surcharge of vital options that it casts into the arena of life and its surrounding ring of near life, allowing those options to strive for self-realization or self-perpetuation by whatever means available. In other words, nature essays. It attempts, experiments, tries, and ventures the new, the variant, the possible, and the unprecedented. Nature is through and through possibilitarian, forever incubating, combining, and essaying the range of possibilities. In the Western tradition, nature has often been compared to a book. But if nature is like a book, that book is more of a collection of essays than a systematic treatise or traditional novel. With this difference, that its essays are writing themselves without understanding the sentences out of which they are composed. In the realm of nature, making comes first, and knowledge, if it comes about at all, comes later. That's why here I would call on the authority of one of the great trustees who sits on the board of entitled opinions, Giambattista Vico. Vico wrote a century before Darwin, yet most of the modern science that came after him confirmed Vico's epistemological principle that we only know what we ourselves make. Verum et factum convertuntur. The true and the made are convertible. First we make, then we come to know. Again, that is how natural selection operates. First it makes through trial and error. First it essays, and when one of its essays gets selected, it keeps a genetic code of its own blueprint for further replication. This is what I meant when I spoke about nature's essayistic élan vital. Now on to our show. The guest who joins me on Entitled Opinions today is Tamara Kayali. She is a postdoctoral fellow in the Novel Tech Ethics team at Dalhousie University up in Canada. She recently completed her PhD in the Department of Social Sciences at Cambridge University with a dissertation on issues of control, responsibility, and the self in depression, using qualitative interviews with women to explore her topic. Tamara has lectured in bioethics at Sydney University and the Australian National University. She has a variety of research interests, but is primarily interested in neuroethics and the ethics of reproduction. For example, questions such as what policies schools and universities should adopt on the use of cognitive enhancers to improve exam performance, as well as issues related to the genetic engineering of children and embryo selection for non-medical reasons. Tamara joins me today to talk about bioethics. We've never done a show on bioethics before, and I, for one, am looking forward to our conversation, but I can't resist mentioning one other anecdote. In her email to me, Tamara informed me that after finishing her dissertation, she took a part-time job in one of the college libraries at Cambridge, and that it was tedious work that involved scanning books into the computer system, but she could listen to her iPod while she worked, and, I'm quoting her again, "I wanted to listen to something intellectual and stumbled upon entitled opinions and actually looked forward to work because of it. When I listen to it, I feel that I'm tuning into an underworld of kindred spirits." So here you are. Welcome to the underworld.
Thanks very much. It feels unreal to actually be on the other side.
Having already listened to a number of shows, Tamara, you know by now that I am extremely wary of what Martin Heidegger called technicity, above all when it comes to forms of biotechnologies. I mean things like genetic engineering of crops, which is a widespread practice these days, and one that raises, for me, a host of social, political, ecological, and ethical questions. I also mean things like the reproductive technologies that are in place today, the genetic engineering of children, cognitive enhancement, and embryo selection. But before we get into some of the controversial issues, could I ask you to please say a word about your discipline, namely bioethics? What exactly is bioethics in your view?
So I understand bioethics to mean ethical issues concerning biology, biological research and applications of biology, as well as medicine, being the clinical practice, medical research, and medical technologies. So this is very wide. And if you think about it, actually, it's also very interdisciplinary. So it involves not just philosophers, but also sociologists, lawyers, medical practitioners, anthropologists. All of these sort of disciplines can weigh into bioethics. So it's quite, for me, it's a wide definition. It can encapsulate practices such as abortion, euthanasia. These are quite old practices. And it can go all the way to IVF, that's in vitro fertilization, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which is embryo selection, basically. And perhaps in the future, genetic engineering of children, as we already said, genetic engineering of crops, and also neuroscientific advances. So it's
so these are, you're describing here biotechnologies.
Yes.
About which bioethics has something to say. Do you understand bioethics to be offering, or should it be offering, a set of prescriptions or moral mandates, ethical imperatives, to regulate the development and dissemination of biotechnologies? Or do you understand bioethics to be something that does not presume to aim at matters of principle, general, let's say, universal principle, but applies to local practices in their particular circumstance? And as you were mentioning, you're interested in the social context as well as natural context and the kind of repercussions that certain biotechnologies will have in particular environments, huh?
Yeah, I think it depends what kind of a bioethicist you are. If you're taking the case-based approach, which I tend to take, you will look at different biotechnologies on a case-by-case basis and look at often your intuitions and apply ethical principles out from there, expanding out from what your particular intuitions are. I don't actually want to pin myself down to that particular approach, but I do often feel inclined towards it. The other approach is a principalist approach, which, as you said, works from particular principles and flows out from that to apply those principles to different ethical problems and issues. And ideally, bioethics is seeking answers, to seeking to gain the most ethical solutions to problems that perplex us and controversial technologies that people are worried about and what we should do with them. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a few cases, if you don't mind.
Yep.
You talked about abortion and euthanasia as being classical. They're not directly associated with biotechnology, but they do have a lot to do with bioethics, if you want to look at it that way. So let's take some traditional, classical instances before we talk about the much more sinister, for me, sinister cases of what we're now calling novel tech.
Sure.
Biotech, okay? So abortion, for example. How do you approach an issue like that?
So for me, I'll say up front that I take a somewhat different perspective on abortion to the way it's often debated in bioethics. So most people will be familiar with the debates on the moral status of the embryo and the fetus and the rights of the mother versus the rights of the fetus, and various different, very good philosophical arguments have been proposed about it. I will say up front that I am pro-choice. I come from a feminist perspective. But at the same time, I have read some, I've done a bit of research on the social context of abortion. Mainly, what fueled this actually was questions around, well, since contraception is so widely available. Of course, that depends on which country you're in, but in many countries like the UK and Canada and Australia, which I'm most familiar with, it's relatively easy to get a hold of contraception. It's quite affordable. And yet, why are there still so many unplanned pregnancies to begin with? And the answers that I found to that shocked me quite a bit. And what I found was that if you look at the demographics of abortion, what are the kinds of people that are requesting it? There was, I'll take as an example, one quite large study that was done in Australia of, in 1996, there was close to 15,000 women aged between 18 and 23 that were surveyed. And the women who reported teenage terminations were more likely to be in a de facto relationship, less well-educated, have no private health insurance. And these are things that you may well predict. When I ask people, what would you predict? They often come up with these things. But what I didn't expect was also that they are also more likely to have been a victim of partner violence. And the shocking stat on this was that partner violence is the strongest predictive factor of pregnancy termination among young Australian women. And women who had ever experienced partner violence were more than twice as likely to have had an abortion than those who had not experienced partner violence before. And that's actually probably an underestimation. So when I put that in the context of the debate, it looked to me quite shocking, because I hadn't envisaged that partner violence would be such such a strong predictive factor of abortion, and it's it figures so little in the debates. So it started to become clear to me that maybe abortion is a little bit like a Band-Aid solution, that yes, it probably prevents women from, I mean, we don't want women who have been the victims of partner violence to also then be forced to have a baby that they don't want. But what is the problem that we're trying to solve? If what's at issue here, if a big fueling factor is coercion and violence, that's fueling the need for this technology, if you will, then we're not really solving the root of the problem. And there's a more social problem that maybe we need to approach with different techniques at the same time.
Well, I don't understand why those who are in abusive relationships are less prone to take birth control than those who are not. I mean, if as you say, if contraception is readily available, why are they getting more pregnant in abusive relationships and hence are having more abortions? I mean, but these are sociological, statistical issues that I guess would be interesting to pursue if we're interested in the sociology of the bioethical issues here in this case. And I appreciate the fact that you want to deal with these particularities of cases. And in this case, you're bringing forward empirical evidence that actually you're right. It's not part of the usual discourse when you start when you figure out that that there's some other things going on in the case of people who do opt for these abortions. But that, again, is not a matter of principle. This is a matter of looking at the embeddedness of a certain practice of, let's say, abortion or euthanasia within in the larger social context.
That's correct.
I guess the listeners of this program, the regular listeners, know that I have some particular set of concerns that are less sociologically oriented and more, what can I say, existentially oriented, politically oriented as well, and certainly, you know, philosophical in nature. And I guess I'm interested in pushing you a little bit in that direction.
Sure.
And would you agree that there is a qualitative difference between what you call these classical bioethical and biotechnological issues like abortion and euthanasia, which you don't really need any biotechnology for? They've been practiced, you know, for millennia. It's not something that arises necessarily with our own modernity. There are more refined ways to achieve these results, if you like. But that there's a qualitative difference between those and certain novel technologies that are being experimented with as we speak, and which seem destined to develop into ever more sophisticated forms of things like cognitive enhancement of offspring's, you know, their abilities, or cloning, genetic engineering, and so forth. Am I being naive to think that we're talking about a new sort of game here, related to the old for sure, but the new set of rules, and that there's something that is far more worrisome going on?
I think you're right in thinking that there is something on a different scale here. I think what we're trying to achieve is very similar to what we've always been trying to achieve. Novel biotechs, I think, up the ante, because splicing fish genes into a tomato, no amount of selective breeding is going to achieve that.
Right.
So that is something unprecedented that we couldn't have achieved otherwise. Novel technologies to do with neuroscience are really moving quickly. They're fascinating. Deep brain stimulation, as we're going to talk about later on, fMRI, scanning and computer technologies, these are fields which are proposing to do things that really we only dreamed about before or were in sci-fi novels. So I think, yeah, we have to recognize what is similar. So when it comes to, for example, genetic engineering of children, which we can't currently do, but there's a lot of debate about what we might do in the future. And I think it is very worthwhile recognizing where there are similarities between trying to engineer children, if you will, environmentally, say by using private school tuition, special classes, tennis lessons, music lessons, for example, which seem to have the same aim as, say, engineering a special musical or sporty gene.
Right. That's the issue, isn't it? Because I agree, environmental engineering, you could say, is on the same order as genetic engineering because it brings about a similar set of results if you're one of these ambitious parents who will do anything to get their child into Harvard or Stanford or what have you.
Sure.
And though they, for me, are the problem, not just the parents, but those who will use any means necessary to achieve their own venal objectives, if I may put it that way.
Sure.
But here, I'm thinking now of Francis Fukuyama's book, Our Post-Human Future, where he speaks about genetic engineering and cloning, but he says that the real problem facing us is psychopharmacology. Because, if I remember correctly, he discusses the example of Ritalin, which is the drug that is prescribed massively for boys who have a kind of rambunctious behavior and attention deficit disorder, another kind of fabricated medical condition that benefits the pharmaceutical industries that promote the drug, and that even the parents who are aware that they might be using a drug in order to suppress perfectly natural, healthy behavior on the in their children will do so nonetheless because it makes their own lives easier. Now, you can imagine that if they're willing to over-prescribe Ritalin to their kids, that how much more ready will parents be to prescribe things that are not just going to make their lives easier, but are promoted, that are going to make their children's, the prospects for their children's future more bright, and are going to make them more athletic and more intelligent and more beautiful, and we're already starting to see a genetically engineered. So what really worries me is the consensus in the population at large. What happens in the laboratories is one thing. And, you know, the scientists and who are trying to make a name for themselves by advancing as far as they can the biotechnological advances, that's one thing. That we could deal with them as a different kind of pathology. The pathology that worries me, and I think it's, if I understand Fukuyama correctly, it worries someone like him, is that there is such a readiness on the part of the citizenry as a whole to wholly embrace, in a mindless way, biotechnologies whose consequences for human society as a whole and for our whole political system as a whole cannot possibly be foreseen, controlled, or predicted at the moment in which one is adopting these things. So, I know that you've worked on cognitive enhancement from psychopharmaceutical. Do you have a bioethical position or stance on this issue?
Yeah, well, I would actually agree with you somewhat on your assessment of Ritalin. No doubt there is probably a small percentage of children maybe that that have some kind of, you know, a real problem of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But the stats on it show that countries like the U.S. far outstrip any other country when it comes to the consumption of Ritalin, the prescription of Ritalin for children. And it does seem like there's a number of factors that converge in favor of this. So, of course, the pharmaceutical companies have an interest in selling their drug. Teachers have an interest in keeping their children under control and don't like dealing with problem children or children that are, as you said, too rambunctious. And parents don't like feeling like maybe they're at fault. Maybe they're not disciplining their children enough. So it's easier to say, well, maybe my child has a problem that just needs to be medicated. And so it's a number of factors all rolled into one. And of course, the child can also buy into this. I think the part of the problem with this over-medicalization of perhaps behaviors that are quite normal and natural is what happens to the child's feelings of responsibility when they grow up. How long are they going to feel dependent on this medication in order to function? And these kind of issues are issues that we find occur also in depression. These issues of the self control and responsibility that people grapple with when they take psychopharmaceuticals, and it's not even for enhancement. What we're talking about here is ostensibly treatment of depression and of ADHD. So what happens when we take these medications and there seems to be nothing wrong with us? What we're trying to do is, for example, there's a drug called modafinil, which is supposed to be prescribed for people who suffer from narcolepsy, over sleeping during the day, sleeping too much. But it can be taken by, say, truck drivers who need to stay awake, nurses on night shifts, or even students. There might be students in Stanford right now who are taking modafinil to stay awake and alert and perform better at exams or their school performance. So if we start to become feel dependent on these kind of drugs, I think we need to think about what's going to happen.
Well, that's great, Tamara. We can go on thinking about it and, you know, having hypotheticals, but do you have a stance on... So let me phrase the question in a different way. If parents are so ready, a certain kind of bourgeois parent, I mean, bourgeois in the Nietzschean sense of the last man type, to risk their children's perhaps health as well as psychic health by over-prescription of Ritalin. And I don't think there's hardly an intelligent parent that doesn't realize that there is a lot of risk, at least some risk involved. If they're willing to take that risk, what will cause them to hesitate if given the option to remove in the future the gay gene from the embryo of an unborn child, or an alcoholic gene, or some. So already we're talking about this absolute sovereignty of the parent over the biological, social, psychological destiny of a parent, and that you're removing from all future generations a genetic legacy that otherwise would have been active in the future progeny of that unborn child. So the difference between psychopharmaceuticals and this intervention in the genetic makeup is that there's something irreversible in the decision to remove, if they were to find the gene for homosexuality or the gene for alcoholism or any kind of deviant behavior, that this sort of what Hannah Arendt calls acting into nature, where nature and the difference between action in the world, in the human world to which action properly belongs, I'm entirely with Hannah Arendt on that, and acting into nature where human action has no business extending itself into nature, is that in the human world, what she calls promise and forgiveness are always open. Whereas in the world of nature, nature is unforgiving. And you cannot make a promise. As human beings, we cannot promise that something is going to be fine before we act into nature and find that it's not fine after all. We cannot hold that promise. We cannot honor that promise, nor is nature forgiving of these kinds of mistakes. In fact, it can lead to disasters. This is a bioethical issue that worries me a great deal, because we seem to be very close, as we speak, to these kinds of decisions being handed over to individuals who have shown on record not to have much compunction when it comes to engineering their own children's social outcome and their chances for success.
Yeah, I actually find myself agreeing with you here, only in the sense that, yes, these things are potentially irreversible. So we'd better darn well know what we're doing when we do them. But my worry is not so much acting into nature just because it's nature and nature has rules that we shouldn't be playing around or playing God with. And if I can fight one philosopher with another, I might throw Sartre at Hannah Arendt. And Sartre says, Jean-Paul Sartre, that is, says that we have to recognize that we have a fear of freedom, of our own freedom. Now, that while that doesn't give a carte blanche to do anything that we want, I think we should recognize when we feel worried or scared about doing something and try to tease out, and this I think is part of the job of a bioethicist, is to tease out exactly why we're worried and the risks associated with it, with what it is that we're proposing to do, but also not be afraid to question our current practices. So if we find that, well, let's say, for example, genetic engineering of our children to become musical geniuses has the same intention behind it as sending them and forcing them to play piano for hours and on end, if we feel that those two practices have a lot in common, I don't think we should be afraid to question our current practices then. And then in that case, it might be that new biotechnologies that come up, when we debate them, and then perhaps they shine a new lens on current practices that we weren't questioning, that maybe we might say, well, maybe we need to rethink what our intentions are behind having children in the first place, and having, why do we want to have particular children? What is fueling this need? And that is something I'm really interested in.
Well, I can appreciate that. I find that it's eminently reasonable. And yet I also do not believe that reason has a lot of compelling power when it comes to regulating or warning people, let alone the industries that promote these practices, about the potential danger. So you speak about Jean-Paul Sartre and throw him at Hannah Arendt. Sartre, yes, he did say that we have a fear of our own freedom. Sartre was the one who resisted any attempt at the naturalization of the human. He thought that the human was an exception to in the order of nature, because precisely this unconditional freedom of the self, which is not reducible to any of its natural determinations. He called for radical self-responsibility, that we have to take responsibility for all, that we are the authors of our own lives, and that we are the authors of our world. We have the world we deserve, he said. Therefore, I agree that from a Sartrean perspective, what he would call for is a radical assumption of responsibility for our actions in this sphere.
Yeah.
And that means that we have to take full cognizance of what it is we are bringing about. Now, if you can assure me that it is all possible at the present moment to take full cognizance of what we are bringing about, then I will be persuaded that we can apply, that we can take full Sartrean responsibility for what we are doing. I happen to believe that there's such a huge mismatch between what biotechnology, what it has released into the world in terms of possibilities for the alteration of natural processes and the alteration of the human species itself, such a disconnect between that and the absolute crude primitiveness of our own consciousness and awareness, that we are still the same extremely fallible, if not wretched and depraved creatures that we always were, that if you hand over to our own desires and decisions questions about the fate of the use of these biotechnologies, I fear, in fact, I'm almost certain that we're in for a heap of trouble, because I think human motivation is mostly profane, and it doesn't think long term. Its objectives have proven to be extremely self-centered and narrow, and so forth. So I just worry about handing over to individuals' desires these kind of decisions, because I don't think most people, and even governments, if you want to go that far, have shown that they're willing to step up to the responsibilities of this unconditional freedom that Sacht was talking about, especially in this area.
I agree with you. I think Sacht places a lot of emphasis on the responsibility that we have to take. I think there is a real emphasis within bioethics on individual choice. That seems to reign supreme. At least it's the most popular view that that bioethicists take, is that if anything, we should veer on the side of allowing parents to decide what choices they make with technology. If this were to become available, they should be able to decide under the banner of reproductive choice, reproductive freedom, how many children to have, if they want children, and within that, what kinds of children to have. I'm skeptical of this, though, not just because I wonder whether parents are really ready to take responsibility for the consequences, but also whether society is really equipped for the consequences. And I think we need to look more not just at individual practices or likely practices that individual parents are going to take, but the likely effects that these practices are going to have for society. For example, if genetic engineering of children were to become available, the way that society is structured right now means it will probably be quite expensive, probably only available to the rich, and for that reason could just amplify the advantages that the rich could have and widen the gap even more between the rich and the poor. There could be a genetic arms race, in the sense that even if you don't particularly want to engineer your child because Joe Blow next door and everyone else is doing it, you feel your children might be at a disadvantage if you don't do it. So I think...
I agreed. But then, again, I don't want to insist too much on Fukuyama. I'm not a Fukuyamist, as it were. However, he being a political scientist, is interested in the political response to the dangers of post-humanist biotechnologies. And he thinks it's necessary to have governing bodies at the national and international level that would regulate and draw lines beyond which you cannot go. So I'm thinking, for example, of, by analogy, in the sports world, about all this kind of doping that we never hear the end of these things. I mean, Lance Armstrong, you know, recently being stripped of all his titles, and then you read about the various kinds of enhancements, physical enhancements that certain drugs and techniques could provide. But if everyone in a particular sport, we saw that in baseball, if everyone in a particular sport is abusing steroids or certain kind of enhancers, then if you want to play that game, you're going to have to start using those enhancers yourself. Otherwise, you're just not going to be able to play the game. And if you have what you call a genetic arms race, and if you have the freedom where some people are allowed to engage in it, then it's going to force everyone else. That's why I'm with Fukuyama when he says what we need is to have proscriptions against certain, the adoption of certain technologies, just the way they do it in sports. So anabolic steroids are not permissible, or cognitive enhancement at the genetic level, or even through psychopharmaceuticals are just that. Yes, that these kinds of regulation are absolutely necessary at the collective level. Everyone has to play by the same set of rules. Otherwise, yeah, we're going to turn into a race of immortals and mortals, the damned and the saved, all, you know, belonging to the same species. If the human species remains a human species, because that's something that Hannah Arendt already 50 years ago, I have a quote here from her. It's she was reflecting on contemporary sciences, you know, acting into nature, and she was thinking about things not related to biotechnology as much as, for example, nuclear fission and fusion, which are events that in nature take place only in remote stars and collapsing stars, but we have found a way on Earth to produce something that would never, ever take place on Earth through this acting into nature. And what does it give us? It gives us the atomic bomb. Welcome to the new world, as such. She says, quote, all our pride in what we can do will disappear into some kind of mutation of the human race. As if she were sensing that a post-human future was at hand. And let me quote her again. The stature of man would not simply be lowered by the unearthly nature of contemporary science, but have been destroyed altogether. So here's one of the dangers. It's not modifications within the human realm, but such a transmutation, such a mutation of human nature itself that we can no longer call ourselves human, at least not the way we've been human, you know, since our early prehistory.
Yeah, it's actually something I found an anthropologist that can probably, I think she would agree with your sentiments here. Her name is Amber Case, an anthropologist who is interested in cyborgs. And she believes we're actually already cyborgs, because if you take the definition of cyborg to be an organism, the quote is, to which exogenous components have been added for the purpose of adapting to new environments. So we can look at, say, spacesuits as being an example of one of those, or deep sea divers who wear special suits to adapt to that environment. But
the iPhone.
Exactly. Well, she raises the iPhone and mobile phones and laptops as examples of technology that is an extension of who we are, but less in the physical sense and more in the mental sense. That it's an extension of our mental self now, not just our physical self, which is challenging and changing the nature of humans and what we look like. And she argues that online personality is like a second self. Mm-hmm. So your web page, your Facebook is a second self presentation. So in that sense, I might agree with Hannah Arendt. I'm not skeptical of technology per se, just simply because it's fiddling with nature. But I do worry when we up the ante with doing things that are irreversible, and doing things that we might be doing prematurely before we know the full implications. And if we're still looking narrowly, if we're not looking at the wider implications, not just for other human beings, but for other animal species and for the biosphere.
Well, can you say something about this new technology that you were telling me about before coming on air of mind reading? What do you call it? There's an acronym for it. I don't remember what it is.
Actually, I'm not sure that there is an acronym for it. It uses fMRI.
fMRI
imaging of the brain and along with computers. And it is aimed to read your mind. The thing that they've managed to do so far, they've done a couple of things. One of them is they've got a bunch of volunteers, these scientists, and get them to watch a Hollywood trailer, a Hollywood movie trailer, and match up the images that they're seeing with the fMRI images of their brains as they're seeing each image. And then they take away the Hollywood trailer and they tell the participants, okay, now I want you to visualize some of the images that you just saw. And what the scientists are able to do is just by looking at the fMRI scan of the brain, they can tell what image that person is thinking of.
Right.
So far, they can only do it for images that the person's already seen and the computer has been able to match it up with. But of course, they're looking into expanding this to be able to just tell what images you're thinking of.
Well, you see, for someone like me, this is horrifying to an unspeakable extent because on the one hand, there's nature, that one acts into nature and you can genetically modify crops and so on. Then there's biotechnology that has to do with the body and let's say enhancement or even musical talents. But then, as you said, now we're talking about what we are going to soon be capable of doing when it comes to our minds and our mental life, and that you have these prostheses which have to do with our mental selves, not our physical selves, the iPhone, the computer. And when you talk about the cyborg, if you're getting to that point where now you can collapse the boundary between a person's inner thoughts and the neighbor's inner thoughts, that is the Borg collective, where now there is no more self, as Hannah Arendt would say, the thinking self, which is in a dialogue with itself in solitude. It's my dialogue with myself that takes place, I don't want to say inside the brain, it's a mental space, but that space of solitude, which is impenetrable by the other, requires that I meet the other, that I meet my neighbor, meet my fellow citizen in a space in the world that comes between men, as she says, and I do it through language, speech, deed, action, and this is the world of appearance. If we are going to collapse the space between minds and have a Borg collective where now then we are a synthetic and organic, or the synthetic is not just attached to the organic, it becomes the actual destiny of the organic. And for those of us who are committed to preserving what is human about the human species, that, yeah, it is horrifying.
Yeah, actually, that seems to resonate a lot with what this anthropologist Amber Case is saying, that, when we're needing to be constantly connected to people on our mobile phones, and we feel lost when we lose our mobile phone, and we feel this constant need to be texting, interacting on the internet, and there's no space for self-reflection. We seem to be increasingly afraid of just sitting there and thinking and being alone with our thoughts. And the replacement of electronic communication for person-to-person interaction might have some really strange effects on, you know, getting to know your neighbor and as well as getting to know yourself. So I do think that if we lose our or have less time for self-reflection, we have less time for long-term planning. Daydreaming, I think, is right. important for long-term planning and our idealism.
Well, again, what terrifies me the most is not so much the technology. The existence of the technology terrifies me to the extent that I'm sure there's a host of people and my neighbor or my fellow citizen who are enthusiastic about the prospect of this kind of mind-reading technology and who would be more than happy to be able to download directly into their brains things from the internet so that they don't even have to have the mediation of the computer. And as you were telling me, if you could download a Spanish language program before you go to Spain, it's just right there. The amount of people who would willingly and enthusiastically embrace it, I think that's where the devil lies. Is in the, again, as I said at the beginning of the program, it's the consumer. And the consumer's demand, if we allow the consumer's demand to dictate the policies regarding these novel biotechnologies, then I think we're in a heap of trouble.
Yeah, exactly. I think the problem is that these are potentially really powerful tools that could be used for good as well as bad. This mind-reading technology could potentially solve a lot of issues. There are people, for example, who are completely paralyzed, but by the use of mind-reading might be able to move robotic instruments to help them. But at the same time, you can obviously envisage how it could be used for bad. And if we were, like I said, in the future, this hasn't been developed yet, but if we were able to download software onto our brains just like we can to our computers, if this were to replace education, I think that would be very dangerous and scary. We can see, obviously, the advantages of this kind of technology, but I think in the context of a consumerist culture that has really overtaken the world, we need to look at how is it most likely going to be used, not just how in principle will it be used.
Well, it sounds to me like you are in the most essential domain is around there today, certainly in our academic worlds, which is bioethics, because it's a whole new world that we're entering, and we didn't even talk about the way bioethics is originally a concept about medicine in the biosphere as such, and that not only in its relation to animals, but with plant life and with all of life. So.
Yeah, sure. That was one of the conceptions of it back in 1970 by a biochemist by the name of Potter. But it's since been left aside, and I think it would be quite advantageous if we were to revisit that definition again.
Right. So I am delighted that I was able to provoke some entitled opinions out of you on this topic because and I appreciate the way that you measure, these judgments, because it will require a discriminate form of judgment and case by case sort of study looking in the details. I would probably be very bad in a kind of policy making body because my extremism would probably cause most people to just kind of discount. as not being within the ballpark of these things, but
it's so much fun to be extreme.
Well, that's where we can do it on the radio. We can do it on Entitled Opinions. So, Tamara Cayali, thanks again for coming through to talk to Entitled Opinions. You are here from Dalhousie in Canada, and the next time you come through the Bay Area, let me know because we have a lot to continue on this discussion. And let me remind our listeners, we've been speaking with Tamara Cayali from Dalhousie, a PhD from Cambridge, bioethicist, neuroethicist, and I am Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Take care.